Welcome to my podcast, Living with Ovarian Cancer. My name is Diane Evans-Wood and I'm one of many women who are living with ovarian cancer. I want to give women like me a voice to share with you what it's like to live with ovarian cancer. We will cover a whole range of aspects related to diagnosis, treatment, recurrence and, well, just about everything in between. I hope you find our honest, candid, but often humorous conversations not only useful, but also uplifting. So without further ado, settle down and listen to my conversation today. Welcome to another episode of Living with Ovarian Cancer podcast. Now, before I introduce my guest today, please could I ask you to subscribe to the show and leave a 5-star rating after you've listened. It really does help the show to become more visible for people to find. Now, today I'm very honoured to be talking to Lexi Mestas in America. I got to know Lexi through social media and because we share the same rare ovarian cancer diagnosis. The difference, though, is our age. Lexi is much younger than me, but I will let her tell her own story in her own words. So, on with the show. Hey, Lexi, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure. Yeah, thank you for joining me. I know that this episode will go out later, but it's Easter Monday, isn't it? So when we arrange this, I'm so sorry I didn't realise it was Easter. And we've just had a little chat and I'm so relieved that it's not encroaching on your family time.
Yeah, we spent all of our time yesterday and really, really, really enjoyed it.
Oh, that's great. Lexi, can you tell me just a little bit about you, who you are, what makes you you, where you live, that sort of thing?
Sure. So I live right now in Mobile, Alabama. It's a coastal town in Alabama. And even though it's one of the bigger cities in Alabama, it feels quite small to me, but it's home. And we moved here after 5 years of living in Philadelphia, which is where I was diagnosed and treated. And we decided to take some time to be home. And so right now I'm living here with my husband and my adopted senior dog, Val. And he's very sweet. And I spend day to day, I do some freelance social media management, but I spend a good chunk of my time raising awareness and fundraising through mm-hmm. social media. And that feels very right for me because in my past life, I was working in public health and urban food access in some of our most in need communities, teaching families and kids how to grow their own food and access healthy food. And so I've sort of pivoted a little bit in the public health world and started focusing mm-hmm. more on our very much overlooked mm-hmm. cancer.
Yeah, the content that you create is just amazing. And it's so relatable because we were speaking earlier, weren't we, just before we started recording, and you were saying that you put different posts up, you create content, and then you get all these messages, me too. And it's so true, isn't it? You know, people just are not talking about it, and it's so good to raise that awareness. I think you're absolutely incredible, Lexi, for doing what you're doing.
It makes me feel incredible to have some action. I'm a very action oriented person, and you know, even through chemo, I started fundraising awareness on, I remember the day, March 21st, last year of 2021. And I just kind of hit the ground running because I'm not someone who, I'm very bad at sitting still and being still. I need to be doing and creating and making and changing. And I found that Instagram was just such an easy way for me to do that in a place that felt very comfortable and creative and flexible around, you know, a situation that needs so much flexibility. Whenever you're diagnosed, you go through so much. Being able to pick up my phone and make a fun video.
Yeah.
And of course, you are a little bit taking that risk of like, I feel this thing and I think it's funny and I'm putting it out there. And it is so rewarding to know that, you know, even if it is a little bit dark humor or has that to it, that people do message you and say like, oh my gosh, I feel this too. And I it makes me feel so much better that someone else is going through that. And I always say, likewise, like I am not putting this out there assuming that everyone else feels this way. Some of these I put out there because I am feeling this way, and to have you validate that as well is just as powerful. So it has been such a bright spot for me.
Yeah, I think humor really does come into it. It's so important, and I wouldn't worry too much about the dark humor. I think if it was somebody creating content that had never been through this, never experienced it, then I think people could be forgiven for thinking, what? But the fact is that you have been through everything that you are creating the humor about. And so you're entitled, perfectly entitled, to create that content. So keep on doing what you're doing, because you are reaching so many people of so many different ages as well. It's amazing.
Yeah, you know, it really sent off the entire idea. And I had been very active on social media, raising funds and kind of sharing my story through the diagnosis. And then the algorithm changed a lot and they started really pushing this short form video. And I heard this audio one day, which is kind of how it goes, where I hear an audio and then I decide like, oh, this idea would be perfect for this. Just see on my face, like I smile at just thinking about, just it brings me a lot of joy. And this audio was very, it was kind of snarky and providing a congratulations to someone. And I used it to bring awareness to sort of how I was feeling around fertility. And since I have moved home, the culture is very different here in a smaller town than it is in a bigger city, where people my age really are more career driven and they're not as focused on building their families. And moving home, almost everybody my age not only is pregnant or has a child, but they have multiple children. And so I feel often very out of place. And I made this video, this kind of snarky video saying like, congratulations, Rebecca, and framed it around fertility. And so many people reached out, the cancer patient account reposted it. And it was just that kind of set off the entire idea. And now it has become a religious thing for me almost to make a post every day and share it out with some perspective and just feel less alone in it, because it's not just our cancer that has experiences the infertility issues. AYA patients who go through treatment oftentimes do struggle with infertility, and it's a very hard and isolating thing to go through already to be a cancer patient, but to not be able to relate to your friends and peers in such a kind of intimate way, like you're missing out on this life cycle experience, is incredibly hard. Incredibly.
You know, it's something that I suppose it had touched my mind. And obviously, you know, I'd not really come across so many young people with this cancer until sort of in the last year or two. But particularly with you raising the awareness of the infertility, it really, really touched my heart. And I have sat there in tears and watching your little videos about it, because it's made me feel so humble and so grateful for everything that I've got, because I just feel that at the age of 49, when I was diagnosed, I had had my son, and it made me feel so incredibly grateful that I'd had that opportunity. But then it turned my focus to what on earth is it like for people of your age. Now, for the listeners, how old were you when you had your surgery?
I was diagnosed at 27 on February 15th of 2021. And by March 3rd, I had my debulking surgery, and that was it. I had a very odd experience with around the fertility discussions. It was very hard. I again was living in a world that was very career centric, and it was something of like, oh, I might have kids when I'm, you know, 35 or
as we do. Yeah.
Or something like that. And it wasn't something that necessarily crossed my mind. It was like, this might be something that I want to do down the road. I come from a very large family, and it wasn't something that I specifically didn't want, but it was something I did not want right then. And when I was diagnosed, my gynecological oncologist she sat me down and said, you know, because of your age, I have to have this conversation with you, and I have to morally offer you this choice. And the choice is either that, you know, we, you know, there's so little that we know about what you have right now, because we haven't necessarily gone in and done the full debulking surgery. And when they did my emergency ovarian cystectomy, which is how it was found to begin with, the pathology was so small, the sample was so small, that they couldn't say it was low grade serous. So it wasn't until it was brought to tumor ward later on. But she said, you know, we could either preserve everything as is, and, you know, we don't know the estrogen feeds this, or we don't know, and we could let you have a baby and go to full term, and your life span will be severely shortened, or we can go in and remove everything and give Lexi the longest life she can possibly have. And it was obviously extremely crushing to go through that, because I feel, and my husband felt the same way, I'd rather you just tell me, because in reality, this isn't really a choice, is it?
No.
You don't really want, you of course want to choose to live and to be with your partner and to be with your family, and going through something like that is such a gamble. You know, they don't tell you all the risks of this. It might not even work out, and you put yourself in this risk. So it was very difficult for us to go through, and there was a very intense grieving process of just many days where, you know, it was, I joked about it, and that it was sort of like a Nancy Myers, who I love her movies. Something's Gotta Give is one of my absolute favorite. And that scene where Diane Keaton is crying and crying and crying is like, this is my Nancy Myers, Diane Keaton crying montage. Like, I just was crying all of the time, and found so deeply in myself that, wow, maybe this was something that I wanted. And not even necessarily that it was something that I wanted, but I want the choice. Yeah. I can't even make that choice today that, in 5 years' time, we will try. It's not an option. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's even harder for us, because when you're told that the average lifespan is 10 years, you really can't consider adoption. And especially being so early on in my journey and having a recurrence so soon, it makes us, it just feels so volatile. We don't know what will happen. And so we focus a lot on just the absolute joy that we feel together, and we've always had that. And it's very, very hard. And I will also say that the two of us met, my husband and I, when we were 14 and 15, and we've been together for a very long time. And mm-hmm. so we have been through so much together, and we are very good at adapting and adjusting and being mm-hmm. there for one another. But I have to say that while also saying what a privilege it is, because mm-hmm. many people my age or younger, this AYA community, they aren't locked into a relationship like this, that like I am. And fertility can be something that can leave them without a partner. Partners can just leave you. Mm-hmm. I've heard so many stories of people saying my partner left me because of mm-hmm. this. And also that oftentimes not being locked into a relationship, they are going through this alone mm-hmm. without that other person to lean on. So there are so many facets of the fertility piece and being young and trying to remain young and having something so horrific happen to you that takes mm-hmm. your youth away from you in a way.
With the adolescent and young adult community, you have certain expectations in life, don't you, that you're going to be able to go out and meet somebody. So for somebody that's very young and diagnosed with this rare form of ovarian cancer, to go through all the surgery and then actually be told that perhaps they've got no evidence of disease, would expect, I'll go out and meet somebody. That's really difficult, because things change so drastically, you know, to do with your sexuality and well, every aspect of your life, really, emotionally, physically, spiritually. So it's not as easy as thinking, you've just gone through all that surgery and perhaps the chemo and then maybe had a maintenance treatment or not. But yeah, AYA community is dealt a bitter blow, I feel. And it's, I'm learning more and more the impact on all of you because of what you're sharing in social media. Did you get any counseling to help you to come to terms with this?
So when I was first diagnosed, and I love a good therapist, I was like, I'm going to go and find this amazing therapist who specializes in infertility and cancer diagnosis, and it will be great. Well, that it sort of happened and then didn't happen for two reasons. Mm-hmm. One, I was diagnosed during COVID, and that mm-hmm. is very difficult. So anybody who's out there listening to this who has been diagnosed during COVID, it is hard. I hear you. It is tough. I had to go through surgery alone. I went through all my chemo treatments alone. I went through all my appointments alone. It's tough. So going through it during COVID, everyone needed to see a therapist. It started out as, this pandemic has happened. I feel very isolated too. I know people or my family members have passed away. And then everyone was really needing a therapist. So it was really hard to find someone. So when I finally found someone, she didn't accept insurance. She wanted to see me weekly. It was $250 a week. And so it'd be $1,000 a month. So I guess it's actually threefold why I quit, because financially that was another one. Yeah. And the third is that, you know, I realized that she was trying very hard. As a therapist, you're supposed to do this, to pull things out of me and talk about them. And I, in my very Virgo stoic ways, was like, no, this boundary is up, this barrier is up, and I'm in fight mode, and I need to go in as a like survivor mode and do it. And you can look back at my posts, how sort of bubbly and cheery, and that saved me in a lot of ways, because I was able to push aside momentarily all the fears, the anguish over infertility, and get through these terribly difficult situations and on your body that you go through surgery, recovery, chemo. It's tough. So once I got through that, I moved home to Alabama and was able to find a therapist. Does she specialize in infertility? No. Does she specialize in cancer diagnoses? No. But she has been incredible, and she sees me weekly, and she takes insurance. And the relationship that we have has been so amazing. And it feels, you know, everyone goes through their own journey and process of being comfortable about talking to someone about it. But this was the right time for me, and being able to talk to her has changed so much for me about just prioritizing preserving my energy and how I perceive things. And we're even beginning conversations around death and dying and my extreme fear of that. And so it wasn't, I think, the traditional trajectory maybe for to talk to someone. It took me a full year, but I'm here and I'm doing it. And it's so helpful.
Yeah, you have to develop a relationship, don't you, before you can go full on sort of talking about that existential crisis almost, you know. Yeah. It's very deep stuff, isn't it? So you can't just come out of that, you know, Virgo or not. I am actually the same, you know. I'm an Aryan, and I'm the supporter. I'm there, you know, to be there for everybody else. And I find myself thinking I have had some counseling myself, and I find myself thinking, I know where you're going with this. Now, you know, she's using phrases, and I'm thinking, yep, I've done that myself. When I've seen patients, I've asked the same thing. So it's very, very hard to open up straight away, isn't it? You know, it's an ongoing relationship.
It is. And even though I only went for a handful of times to the therapist during treatment the first time, we actually made a point, my husband and I, to go together. And if you're able to stick with that, I really suggest it, because it was so, so interesting to hear his perspective of, you know, what he was going through. I am so entrenched, and not in a way that like I felt burdened by the way that he felt, but I just hadn't imagined that he would be struggling with dropping me off at chemo and driving away and feeling guilty and thinking, why is this not me? Why is it her? And what I, you know, because again, the two of us met when we were 14 and 15. So we've done everything together. We've gone through high school together. We went to college together. We studied abroad together. We've done everything together. So to have this all of a sudden separate life experience and him not be able to understand me in a way to support me in the best way he could was very tough. And that opened up our relationship a lot in this journey to just understanding a little bit more about where each other are coming from, and digging into those tough conversations, because at first we really could not go there. We just could not talk about it. And it was more of just simply the physical comfort.
It's very hard, isn't it? I think when you go through something like this, so life-changing and so deep, I feel, well, it's a well-known fact that it can either make or break a relationship, can't it? But I mean, obviously it's made you even stronger, if it could ever be stronger, but you obviously are absolutely devoted to each other, dedicated. But for some, I found that, you know, I've read stories of people that have ended up being single because they've not coped with their partner going through this, you know, and that must be, well, very hard, devastating.
Yeah. And that's why I do say, you know, that I am privileged in a lot of ways. I can't deny that, and that I am kind of an oddity, and that I am my age, and people for a very long time were like, my gosh, you got married so young at 21 or 22 and everybody else wasn't. And now I look back and I'm so thankful. Of course, we had been dating for 8 years prior to our marriage, and most people don't do that anyway, but we understand each other very well. And we have that benefit, but also that I would not be able to have the time to raise the kind of awareness that I am if my husband were not willing to kind of step up in a way with his career and job and, you know, be supportive in me doing that, because I'm not working full time. I just, you know, I left in February a very, very toxic workspace that I tried to go back into a full-time space, and really rough on me, and the culture was just not a good fit, and decided what I want, you know, you really start asking yourselves, like, what do I want? And what do I want to do with my time? And not assuming that your time will be shortened, but, you know, that time is different to you now. Mm-hmm. It means so much more. And deciding that I really wanted to be part-time working on myself. I can still freelance part-time and work on, you know, other people's social media management and that sort of thing. And it's all fun and well, but it is so empowering to me and so fun and brings me so much joy. And every time I receive a message saying, I was just diagnosed, I'm scrolling at 1:30 in the morning, I can't sleep, and I found your account. I did not have that when just a year ago. I couldn't really find anybody else doing what I'm doing. And I feel that I'm filling a gap and have kinds of conversations. And I've noticed other people popping up and making similar content. And it's obviously a bad business model to be like, oh, I want you to do it too. But it's like, yay, keep going. Like, you do it too, because we need more people talking about this in this way. And what a way to get AYA patients involved is tell your story in a way that helps you cope. Because me laughing hysterically over a video that I created by myself in a room, like, I'm having the best time. And I can't remember the last time that I felt joy like this in my work. So it's funny how things change. But
no, you've obviously gone through some kind of a grieving process, haven't you? And gone through all sorts of feelings related to grief and loss, whether that might be disbelief or whether that might be anger or guilt or depression. You go through the whole lot, but it's cyclical, isn't it? Because you can revisit all of those different feelings at any point in time. You know, it's not like you go through grief and loss like that and then that's it. You know, you can put it behind you. Every now and again it hits you. But having such an enormously supportive husband that can be there and step up and just encourage you and support you in everything else that you want to do, I think is amazing. And everything that you're doing is so worthwhile. And like you say, I think it's important for lots of other people, if they feel they want to do it, because I think the more the better, really. Because we can never have too many people stepping up and raising the awareness.
Absolutely. And you know, you're right that our feelings are cyclical. There is a grieving process, and there is working with a therapist, but it's never really fully gone from you. And you know, especially I had felt like I had made so much progress and I had some sort of semblance of normalcy or a new normal. And then my recurrence happened just 6 months after my frontline treatment.
Yeah.
And I was determined to not be one of those people. And it, especially as a Virgo who wants to have control over all of the things, I can't. And I struggle with that, but that, you know, those, those same day one feelings, I like to call them, those feelings when they tell you this is happening to you and you have that hit you, like anger, fear, you know, fear of death and dying. What does that mean? And all of these different things that happen. And they definitely came back. I feel like I am working through them again, but I have this time the opportunity to capture them in a way that is most popularly absorbed right now in this short form video and with memes and a touch of comedy, and other people can relate to it. And it's twofold in that it helps them, which is amazing, but it also helps me. And
it must be very healing and cathartic for you as well, I feel. I think that's important. It's not just about doing this for everybody else. It's a two-way thing, isn't it?
It is. It is. And I think I was shocked at first at just how great it would make me feel, because I think you get so wrapped up in being a cancer patient and being a cancer survivor and all of the weight that comes with that. It can be hard to feel happiness day to day and find happiness in something new or new normal, because oftentimes, if not always, the old does not fit with who you are now. It's, you know, fitting a square peg in a round hole. It just doesn't work. And it can feel very uncomfortable. And, you know, catching myself, you know, rolling on the ground, making a video and laughing. And I caught myself like feeling truly joyful and wanting to capture that and giving credit to that and saying, this is what makes me feel happy right now. And I'm going, even if this isn't forever, it's what makes me feel good right now. And that also goes with, you know, the fundraising, which is very empowering for me. And when I first started and started having, you know, an impact and really racking up the dollars, Jane Ludeman reached out and was like, even if this is just a season of your life, it's amazing. And, and I think back to that, like, season of your life and just kind of going with the flow, which is a totally new thing for me in a way that cancer has changed me, is that I would never call myself a go with the flow person before all of this happened. But yeah, you just kind of, you're learning about yourself all over again every day. Yeah. And I'm only 1 year into this, and I am just continuing to learn about myself. And because, as you said, things do change very frequently.
They do. And I think as over time, it may be that the content changes to reflect that time of life that you are living in at the time, you know. So you've mentioned about raising money for research. And I know that we both share the same diagnosis of low-grade serous ovarian cancer, which is a rare form of ovarian cancer. So why is it important to raise that money? Why is it so important for you to raise money for research particularly?
Yeah, so when I found out about my diagnosis and then was told how rare it was, I immediately sought out resources and wanted to know more. They say stay off of Google, but I did not. And luckily, Google led me to Cura Our Ovarian Cancer. I did a lot of reading, and on the site there's just so much information and reading that low-grade serous ovarian cancer, this rare subtype that disproportionately impacts people born with ovaries in their 20s to 40s, which is, you know, quite young group, it only receives 1% of all funding for ovarian cancer.
Yeah.
And that was crushing to me, because you want to have hope. You want to have hope that there's going to be some sort of cure or another treatment that gives you more time. And I, you know, going back to my statement about just how actionable I am and that I thrive in a state of action, I felt that I couldn't just do nothing. And I have so many skills that I could put forward to try and make a difference. And for me, again, that was social media. And it was easy for me to be recovering on my couch after chemo and share my story and put up a donation sticker and raise money. I started tracking it, tracking what people gravitated towards. I hosted an in-person event at Oddball, where we all dressed up in different fun wigs. And and I raised over $18,000 in that one night. And I just, you know, I got more intimately involved in it as I went along in donating to MD Anderson's research for low-grade serous with led by Dr. Gershenson and Dr. Wong, and getting to talk to them more about it. It's such a tough cancer, and it's a tough cancer to not only treat, but research, because there aren't that many of us. No. And so there's not a large sample size, and quite frequently the results of trials don't give us great results, or they're not very conclusive, because by the time patients make it to the third leg of the trial, they pass away. And so it makes it really, really hard to come up with conclusive information of why something happened or why this treatment may work or doesn't work. But what I do know is that there is a lot of promise, and because of the impact that has been made in fundraising in the past 5 years, even, there's so much coming down the pipeline. There are 5 trials happening right now and 3 in the pipeline.
Amazing.
Also, that, you know, the medication that I'm on right now was in trial just 5 years ago. And that's amazing. You know, people are being given more time. And what I try and explain to people who don't have this and just see my story, it's the gift of time. We don't know if this is going to be a cure. We hope for a cure, but you're given the gift of hope. You're given the gift of time. And it's just been something that I feel for the first time in my life, a real deep calling to do.
You have that sense of purpose, don't you? I think and you're so good at what you're doing with the raising the funds, but the awareness. It's a tricky customer, isn't it? Low grade, you know, different genetic mutations, and we were lumped in with high grade serous ovarian cancer for so long. You know, and it's fairly new that they've realized that actually low grade is very different to high grade. It's a slippery customer and doesn't respond very well to chemotherapy in the same way, because the cells are so much more slower growing. And so, of course, we're looking at more targeted therapies, and that's where the future lies for us. Really, I know you got to see some low grade cells, didn't you, when you went to MD Anderson?
It was a very surreal moment. I got to see the research lab and was shown low grade serous cells under a microscope. And, you know, I right now have some cancer in me. And I, after my recurrence and the medication seems, I'm not going to say seems, it is working. It's shrunk my, implants by half the size in 3 months, which is incredible and very exciting, but it was a very surreal moment looking through this microscope and seeing what is so in my body in a very weird way.
I know, low grade's very strange, isn't it? Because it doesn't grow like, you know, these big tumors that you can take out. It grows like a plaque, implants, coating the organs, which makes it so difficult to remove everything, you know, when you're doing the debulking surgery. And, you know, invariably they are going to leave something left behind, you know, and because it's slower growing, you know, it gets further along the line before we're diagnosed, and we could have had it for quite some years before we're diagnosed.
It's actually fascinating. I had pain for, gosh, I mean, literally a decade. I was in pain for so long, and it was always something else. It was period pain and IBS and my gallbladder. I had my gallbladder removed and the pain continued, and they'd say, oh, that's unrelated.
Yeah.
And I complained for so long, and my body was just yelling at me that there was something wrong.
Yeah.
And it, you know, that's another huge piece of the spreading awareness. Mm. I was appalled when I was diagnosed that it took this long to figure out what it was, because as soon as my ovaries were removed and I was sewn up, my pain stopped. I got to sleep through the night for the first time in a decade. I was exhausted. I would wake up every night with this horrifying stomach pain. Mm. And it bothered me so badly that I was doing the right things. I was telling my doctors how I felt. I was telling them what symptoms I had. I was Googling and researching, but nothing pointed me towards ovarian cancer. And mm-hmm. I also didn't know that that was something that I should be concerned about. I didn't know that I was at risk for it because I didn't have a history of cancer, let alone ovarian cancer, in my family. Totally healthy person, lifelong athlete, background in nutrition. None of it made any sense. I was absolutely horrified that this could happen, and immediately set off and trying to tell people that this could happen to you too. And, you know, I know that Cure Our Ovarian Cancer has recently shared that there are an estimated 100,000 people born with ovaries worldwide who yeah. have low-grade serous but do not know it. And I, you know, if you have bloating or abdominal pain or frequent urination or yeah. changes in bowel habits, I urge you, if you have those symptoms for more than 2 weeks, to go talk to your doctor about ovarian cancer and ask for a transvaginal ultrasound, ask for a CA125 blood test, and ask for a pelvic exam, because you're better safe than sorry. I had no idea that this could happen to me. And it's not just a part of my life. It is my life, and it dominates every yeah. aspect of it.
Yeah.
So I just hope that things change, not just for us as people who have already been diagnosed, and that we have hope and have better treatments and have more time, but that people can catch this earlier and don't have to suffer the way that we have.
Definitely. I think you've given good advice there about the symptoms and what to look for, and to be very persistent, because we know our own bodies, don't we? We know our own bodies the best, and we know when there's something wrong. And recently there was a report in the last month, and the gynaecology teams are noticing that there's definitely a gender bias here. And I think that people with ovaries that constantly keep going back to the GPs are fobbed off. I can't say it in any other way, really. Oh, you know, it's just this, it's just that. And when they can't attribute a cause for the constant trips back to the doctor, I think they feel that we're neurotic in some mm-hmm. ways, and that it's all in our heads. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that the listeners can probably hear in my voice, it really gets my heckles up.
Absolutely. The last doctor I spoke to, because my GI doctor laughed in my face after several times mm-hmm. of trying to see him, that, you know, it was in my head, you know, I guess we could do a colonoscopy to figure out, you know, something, but I don't really think that that's necessary. Just take some fiber. I was so desperate. I went to a homeopathic doctor who I went to because my friend went to him and she suggested him. And he spent 90 minutes doing a psychoanalysis of me and concluded that the reason for my pain was that I was afraid of the dark.
Oh no, why?
And so he had me take these bizarre drops where I would two drops in a full glass of water, mix it together with a teaspoon, and then take half a teaspoon and throw the rest away. And it was just like snake oil type situation. But just to say how desperate I was to find a solution. I was in so much pain. And I think we are so often not just being brushed off by doctors, but in our own heads, especially as AYA cancer patients, AYAs, we believe, you know, we're young, we're fine. We've been told we're young and fine, and we haven't smoked or we haven't, you know, had excessive alcohol or whatever it is. And so we don't believe that it would be anything serious. Yeah. And I urge everyone listening to give yourself some credit, because like Diane said, you know, you do know your baseline better than anyone else. And when something feels wrong, you are totally valid in trying to get an answer or a solution to that pain.
Yeah. I think knowing the symptoms and knowing what to ask for are very important. So as you've said, if those symptoms are persistent, there is nothing wrong in asking the doctor to take a CA125 test, which is just simply a blood test, and it can check for a CA125 level, which is a protein that is sometimes present when ovarian cancer is present in the body. I mean, obviously, a CA125 might not be raised for every person with an ovarian cancer diagnosis, but for most it is. But definitely an ultrasound scan, particularly the transvaginal. So definitely that. Yeah. I think to those simple facts, I think, will save lives. I feel like absolutely flabbergasted, if I don't know if you know that word in America, but oh, to be told that you're afraid of the dark, it's brought me out in a hot sweat, I can tell you. Oh, it's made me all hot.
It's wild. People think that's a joke, but it really, really happened. And I was willing to do anything. I had it on my goal list for 2020. To find a solution or the answer to my abdominal pain. And it was so, the bloating was just so severe that I would do an exercise or, you know, at any point of the day, my stomach was just stick out almost like I was pregnant. It was rock hard and I couldn't understand it. But, you know, as awful as it is to go through the infertility, and that is just an atrocious experience. It hurts in so many ways. To know that the relief that I feel physically of not having my ovaries in me is just, I mean, it feels unrelated, but it's somehow related. It just is like, I am so thankful to have this level of health again, even though it's weird to say, because I do have cancer in my body right now, but it's not like it was. And I feel so much better. And I've oddly enough, being told you may have an average of 10-year time, you know, 10 years to live, I feel like I can get back to life again in a way of just, I don't have to just suffer in pain every day.
No. So when they, after they discovered that you'd got what looked like, was it an ovarian cyst? Did they then do surgery, discovered that you'd got low-grade serous? Did you have all that major surgery in one go?
No, I had this terrible pain one morning, and usually I could sort of like move about and it would relieve itself. And it was this really intense pressure on my lower left side. And my husband was, you know, this is all COVID times. He's on a Zoom call for work. And all of a sudden I was just vomiting uncontrollably. I could not understand what was happening. I could not think, I could not breathe. And I just pressed my face up against the bathroom tile to try and keep myself from passing out. It was like, everything was going splotchy. Mm-hmm. And we went to the emergency room and my dad said, go. So I knew it was serious because my dad's a nurse. And so is my mom. And when they say, actually go to the hospital, that means it's serious. And so I went, and I was so convinced that this was bowel related, that it was IBS, because I'd been told for so long, it's simple. It's just IBS. You will always have this pain, whatever. And I'm telling them this like through vomiting, and they did one swift listen to my bowels and they were like, everything's moving normally. Mm-hmm. So I, in that moment, just looked at my husband like, what is happening? Like, what could this possibly be? So we spent about a day. I mean, we went in at 9 a.m. into the emergency room, and I did x-rays, blood tests, pregnancy tests. You know, they told me I wasn't pregnant. And I remember feeling joyous at the time because I was so worried that it was like some sort of ectopic pregnancy or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now, of course, I feel guilty saying that, but I ended up having the transvaginal ultrasound. Mm-hmm. And it was the most painful experience because of just how severe the cysts were. And mm-hmm. I did not know that I had cysts until... And I had been gaslit for so long and being told that my pain didn't match what the diagnosis was, that I was feeling too much or whatever. And I asked the woman who did the transvaginal ultrasound, just, I'm out of breath. I'm hurting so badly. And I said to her, does what you saw on the ultrasound match or make sense with how I'm feeling?
Mm-hmm.
She just looked at me and said, sweetie, if I had that, I would not be holding it together as well as you have. And at that point, I knew something was awful because mm-hmm. I didn't know. And she said, I can't tell you, the doctor has to.
Mm-hmm.
So they wheeled me back down, and immediately this like group of like almost like saviors, five female doctors came in just like ready to go. And they had all these papers and they said, you have what we can see now is three ginormous ovarian cysts, the size of your hand on your left ovary alone.
Mm-hmm.
And so large that we actually cannot see your ovary, but we believe that your ovary is twisted and that's what's causing the pain right now.
Yeah.
So they said, we need you to sign these papers. In about 30 minutes, we'll be taking you in for emergency surgery. And I had to call my family. I lived in Philadelphia. I have no family there. I had to call everybody and tell them, and they're all like, what? So I go in, and, you know, a few hours later, wake up, and I'm a very fit person. I was up walking after surgery, took myself to the bathroom, doing all the things. And my doctor came in and she was thrilled that I was walking. And she just said, you know, you had 9 cysts. You had all over your ovaries. And some of them were smaller, some were much larger, but we drained them and we left your ovaries. Your fallopian tubes look great. But we did see some odd markings on your abdominal wall. and they're just microscopic, but we think it's endometriosis, but we biopsied it just in case. And that's how small of a volume of disease I actually had, yeah. is that the biopsy did not confirm low-grade serous. And it wasn't until they went in and did the full debulking surgery on the third, so almost a month later, or about 3 weeks later. And that's when, you know, they confirmed everything and kind of what that meant. And I've always grappled with, like, I don't understand. I'm stage 3C, but you're saying I have a low volume of disease just in a lot of places. Like, it's just a weird cancer.
Yeah.
And unfortunately it is discovered like this in an extreme situation because we have not been listened to. Mm-hmm. And unlike me, you know, where it was like an emergency situation, some people are trying to conceive and they find out about their cancer during a C-section or mm-hmm. while they're going through fertility treatments. And either way, any way you throw the dice, it's tragic and yeah. horrific and scary. And it just feels like so much of it could be resolved by listening to people who are presenting with this kind of pain yeah. and making these tests more normal and more typical, not as taboo to ask for.
I know, how many lives could they save, you know, if they would just do those simple tests and listen, I think.
They're not invasive tests. They're not.
No.
They're not, you know, but I've heard a lot of people, especially in the US, which the US and our insurance situation is
yeah.
a nightmare, to just say that lightly, but say that insurance won't cover those tests until you've shown that there's an actual need for them, which is a little bit backwards, because we can use them in a preventative measure, or not preventative, but if you're beginning to show symptoms, they can catch things earlier.
Quite easily. I know. So where are you at now then? Obviously you went through the surgery and you had chemotherapy and all that goes with that. So then you had a recurrence soon after. How many months after chemo did you have a recurrence?
6 months, from January to December, I had some normalcy, but I had a little bit of the stomach discomfort come back, and not as severe. It was just a little bit, and I'm very in tune with my body, so that mm-hmm. was an alarm for me. And I'm lucky in the sense that my CA125 number is very reliable.
Yeah.
And it jumped from 14 to 46. So I knew immediately that something was wrong. And so I ended up getting a second opinion from Dr. Gershenson, and he was able to confirm that in my past scan that it was there, microscopic, and, you know, we're going to recommend a change in therapy. So instead of doing the letrozole, which is the hormone blocker that is the standard of care right now following chemotherapy, that just didn't touch it. It did not work for me. And we're trying Mekinist or trametinib, which is a MEK inhibitor. It is typically given to patients with melanoma, but it has shown a lot of promise with ovarian cancer. And it's showing a lot of promise for me. I hope that it works for a very long time, but you know, I'm still living and learning to live with the imperfection that, you know, cancer brings to your life.
Yeah. Yeah.
That, you know, day to day, I'm running 5Ks competitively. I'm, you know, enjoying my exercise. I am able to work and find joy and,
yeah.
and normalcy day to day. And I'm happy with that. So, you know, when I talked to Dr. Gershenson about that, for anybody listening who may have had a recurrence, and for anybody who's listening who does have low grade serous, and maybe you don't feel that your care is as great as it should be. And if you're in the US or willing to travel, mm-hmm. Dr. Gershenson is with MD Anderson, and he's the top doctor mm-hmm. to see for a low grade serous. And he's quite amazing and patient and kind and gentle in ways that so many of the doctors that we see are not. But yeah, he told me that it's not abnormal to have a recurrence this quickly. It's about mm-hmm. average, and that 85% of people with low grade serous do recur at some point in time. So it doesn't impact my survivability or, my long-term outcome. It just means, we've learned more about me and how to kind of treat this and work around it. And in the meantime, I will continue raising a bunch of money so that hopefully we have more great treatments coming down the pipeline.
Oh, thank you for sharing so much of everything that you've been through, Lexi. Honestly, I think that a lot of listeners will get so much from what you've said. And I know I could speak to you for far, far longer, but I've kept you for an hour now nearly. And I don't want to take up any more of your time. But thank you so, so much. I think you really are just amazing. And I really mean that from the bottom of my heart. And thank you for everything that you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me. I really, really appreciate you doing this work and making the space. And it's so important. And in a way, you and I are doing some of the same things.
I get to speak to so many amazing people like you. So, it's no great hardship, but it does some good. Yeah. I normally end on a few fun questions, but Can I ask you, I was going to ask you, the usual sort of what song would be your signature tune and all that sort of thing. But to end on, can I ask you about Val? Because yes. I am so intrigued by the story of Val and why you have Val. So to end on, tell us about Val.
Oh, goodness.
And Val is your dog.
I call him my big old man baby because we adopted him. So I have been wanting a dog for a very, very long time. And we lived in Philly in a small apartment and, in a big city. And we're just like, we just really don't have the room unless it's a tiny little dog. And we don't necessarily want that. Well, all of those thoughts went out the window when I was diagnosed. And one of the first things that I asked my surgeon, the woman who did my first surgery and who has followed me pretty much the whole way, just even as like a confidant, she calls me just to check in and say hi, even though she's not my doctor anymore, but I call her my fairy godmother, Dr. L, and she's amazing. And I said to her, I heard about an emotional support animal and, we're going to get you a dog. And luckily she's a big dog person. So mm-hmm. in the US, if you have, anxiety or are going through, a mental health struggle, if you speak to your doctor, your primary care physician or therapist, they can write you a letter depending on which state you live in as well. Says that you need an emotional support animal. And in the state of Pennsylvania, it actually prevents landlords from being able to charge you any money for your pet and also from being able to prevent any breeds. So that meant that we were able to get Val, who is a pit bull terrier mix. And typically pit bulls are on the no list. But he, I had just finished surgery and I really didn't want a puppy jumping up on me. And so we got Val. He's a senior. He was 11 when we got him. So we got the senior discount, which was a little bit lower. Yes, he's just so sweet and lazy. He has hypothyroidism. So we both take our daily pills. He loves to sleep all day and he loves walks, but it has been so nice to have this little source of joy and unconditional love and camaraderie in a sense that really has nothing to do with cancer. You know, he's never asking me about cancer, or he doesn't know that I have a recurrence, and he loves and cares about me no matter what, and is there to comfort me all the time. And his love is lying down on the couch and snuggling. And when you're a cancer patient, you do a lot of that. So it works out, but he is just darling and such a joy, and we love having him.
He gets such a beautiful home with you, but he gives so much at the same time, doesn't he? You know, it's a two-way thing. And I think pets in the UK, we have a scheme, pets as therapy, but it's slightly different. But I think the recognition that animals are very important for our mental health, I think is very well known. And when I worked in the hospice, we always used to have the pet dogs, the pets as therapy dogs. And they would come in and just go and snuggle up with the patients, you know, and oh, it was just wonderful. And it brightened their days. And you just can't help when they look at you with their big eyes. You can't help but just love them, make a fuss of them, stroke them. And for that moment in time, you're distracted. And that's, it works, doesn't it? It really does.
It really does. Even in college, we, you know, during finals, we would all be so stressed out. And my university would bring in a fleet of puppies who were up for adoption and just let them loose in one of the closed in courtyards, and all of the students could come in and play with puppies and feel just a little bit of relief for a little bit until we went back to study for our tests. And it does, it really works. You don't have to be sick to feel like you need an emotional support animal, but it really has made such a difference. And Val is one of the best decisions that we've made since my diagnosis, and especially feeling, I think going back to that fertility thing is, you know, it takes away the feeling. I go back often to the moment that I woke up from my surgery, and I was in that kind of haze of the pain medications and the anesthesia. And I remember looking to my right because they let my husband come in to see me during COVID. I had to be by myself. And I remember having this just a very intense feeling of realizing and remembering that my womb was gone and that I would never be able to have this experience again of looking to my right and seeing my husband there and being proud of birthing our baby and sharing in that joy and like pride together. And I think that having Val, even though he's a senior dog, he needs to be taken care of. And it feels so good to take care of someone, especially as well when you are someone who so many people are trying to take care of, that I can take care of someone else. I'm well enough to do that. And that, you know, I can feed him and take him to the vet and take him for walks and surprise him with trips to the beach and things like that, that are really fun. Mm-hmm. You know, it is, there are so many layers of joy and healing that animals can bring.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so grateful to you for sharing that. And it doesn't have to be a Val dog. It could be any pet, even to the point of having a hamster or a house rabbit or something, you know, something smaller, even a budgie. So it's just so important, an important thing to talk about, I think. Pet. Thank you so much, Fen Lexi. I will share your details, your social media details in the show notes. And I will also share Cure Our Ovarian Cancer Charity as well, because we've mentioned that with Jane. So thank you again, Lexi.
Thank you so much. If anybody wants to reach out and chat, I am always on social media, so feel free to do so.
Thank you for listening today. To hear future episodes of this podcast, please go ahead and subscribe now. I look forward to sharing more inspiring conversations with women who are living with ovarian cancer. Until next time, take care of yourselves and each other, and enjoy all that life has to offer.